Side 10. Kitty smiled and in her heart sighed. There was only one thing she could do for Walter now, and that she could not think how to. She wanted him to forgive her, not for her sake any more, but for his own, for she felt that this alone could give him peace of mind. It was useless to ask him for his forgiveness, and if he had a suspicion that she desired it for his good rather than hers, his stubborn vanity would make him refuse it at all costs. It was curious that his vanity now did not irritate her. It seemed natural, and only made her sorrier for him. And the only chance was that some unexpected occurrence might throw him off his guard. She had an idea that he would welcome an uprush of emotion, which would liberate him from his nightmare of resentment, but that, in his pathetic folly, he would fight when it came with all his might against it. Was it not pitiful that men, tarrying so short a space in a world where there was so much pain, should thus torture themselves? Chapter 60. Though the Mother Superior talked with Kitty not more than 3 or 4 times, and once or twice for but 10 minutes, the impression she made upon Kitty was profound. Her character was like a country which on first acquaintance seems grand but inhospitable, but in which presently you discover smiling little villages among fruit trees in the folds of the majestic mountains, and pleasant ambling rivers that flow kindly through lush meadows. But these comfortable scenes, though they surprise and even reassure you, are not enough to make you feel at home in the land of tawny heights and windswept spaces. It would have been impossible to become intimate with the Mother Superior. She had that something impersonal about her, which Kitty had felt with the other nuns, even with the good-humoured, chatty Sister Saint-Joseph. But with her, it was a barrier which was almost palpable. It gave you quite a curious sensation, chilling but awe-inspiring, that she could walk on the same earth as you, attend to mundane affairs, and yet live so obviously upon a plane you could not reach. She once said to Kitty, "It is not enough that a religious should be continually in prayer with Jesus. She should be herself a prayer." Though her conversation was interwoven with her religion, Kitty felt that this was natural to her, and that no effort was made to influence the heretic. It seemed strange to her that the Mother Superior, with her deep sense of charity, should be content to leave Kitty in a condition of what must seem to her sinful ignorance. One evening, the two of them were sitting together. The days were shortening now, and the mellow light of the evening was agreeable and a little melancholy. The Mother Superior looked very tired. Her tragic face was drawn and white. Her fine dark eyes had lost their fire. Her fatigue perhaps urged her to a rare mood of confidence. "This is a memorable day for me, my child," she said, breaking from a long reverie, "for this is the anniversary of the day on which I finally determined to enter religion. For 2 years I had been thinking of it, but I had suffered, as it were, a fear of this calling, for I dreaded that I might be recaptured by the spirit of the world. But that morning, when I communicated, I made the vow that I would before nightfall announce my wish to my dear mother. After I had received the Holy Communion, I asked our Lord to give me peace of mind. 'Thou shalt have it only,' the answer seemed to come to me, 'when thou hast ceased to desire it.'" The Mother Superior seemed to lose herself in thoughts of the past. "That day, one of our friends, Madame de Vienno, had left for the Carmel without telling any of her relatives. She knew that they were opposed to her step, but she was a widow, and thought that as such she had the right to do as she chose. One of my cousins had gone to bid farewell to the dear fugitive, and did not come back till the evening. She was much moved. I had not spoken to my mother. I trembled at the thought of telling her what I had in mind, and yet I wished to keep the resolution I had made at Holy Communion. I asked my cousin all manner of questions. My mother, who appeared to be absorbed in her tapestry, lost no word. While I talked, I said to myself, if I want to speak today, I have not a minute to lose. It is strange how vividly I remember the scene. We were sitting round the table, a round table covered with a red cloth, and we worked by the light of a lamp with a green shade. My two cousins were staying with us, and we were all working at tapestries to recover the chairs in the drawing room. Imagine, they had not been recovered since the days of Louis XIV when they were bought, and they were so shabby and faded, my mother said it was a disgrace. I tried to form the words, but my lips would not move. And then, suddenly, after a few minutes of silence, my mother said to me, I really cannot understand the conduct of your friend. I do not like this leaving without a word all those to whom she is so dear. The gesture is theatrical and offends my taste. A well-bred woman does nothing which shall make people talk of her. I hope that if ever you caused us the great sorrow of leaving us, you would not take flight as though you were committing a crime. It was the moment to speak, but such was my weakness that I could only say, Ah, set your mind at rest, Maman. I should not have the strength. My mother made no answer, and I repented because I had not dared to explain myself. I seemed to hear the word of our Lord to Saint Peter. Peter, lovest thou me? Oh, what weakness, what ingratitude was mine! I loved my comfort, the manner of my life, my family and my diversions. I was lost in these bitter thoughts when a little later, as though the conversation had not been interrupted, my mother said to me, Still, my Odette, I do not think that you will die without having done something that will endure. I was still lost in my anxiety and my reflections, while my cousins, never knowing the beating of my heart, worked quietly. When suddenly my mother, letting her tapestry fall and looking at me attentively, said, Ah, my dear child, I am very sure that you will end by becoming irreligious. Are you speaking seriously, my good mother? I answered. You are laying bare the innermost thought and desire of my heart. May we, cried my cousins, without giving me time to finish. For 2 years Odette has thought of nothing else. But you will not give your permission, ma tante. You must not bear the innermost thought and desire of my heart. May we, cried my cousins, without giving me time to finish. For 2 years Odette has thought of nothing else. But you will not give your permission, ma tante. You must not give your permission. By what right, my dear children, should we not give your permission? By what right, my dear children, should we refuse it, said my mother, if it is the will of God? My cousins then, wishing to make a jest of the conversation, asked me what I intended to do with the trifles that belonged to me, and quarrelled gaily about some gaiety, lasted a very little while, and we began to weep. Then we heard my father come up the stairs. The Mother Superior paused for a moment and sighed. It was very hard for my father. I was his only daughter, and men often have a deeper feeling for their daughters than they ever have for their sons. It is a great misfortune to have a heart, said Kitty with a smile. It is a great good fortune to consecrate that heart to the love of Jesus Christ. At that moment, a little girl came up to the Mother Superior, and confident in her interest, showed her a fantastic toy that she had somehow got hold of. The Mother Superior put her beautiful, delicate hand round the child's shoulder, and the child nestled up to her. It moved Kitty to observe how sweet her smile was, and yet how impersonal. It is wonderful to see the adoration that all your orphans have for you, Mother, she said. I think I should be very proud if I could excite so great a devotion. The Mother Superior gave once more her aloof and yet beautiful smile. There is only one way to win hearts, and that is to make oneself like unto those of whom one would be loved. Chapter 61. Walter did not come back to dinner that evening. Kitty waited for him a little. He always managed to send her word, but at last she sat down. She made no more than a pretense of eating the many courses which the Chinese cook, with his regard for propriety, notwithstanding pestilence and the difficulty of provisioning, invariably he always managed to send her word, but at last she sat down. She made no more than a pretense of eating the many courses which the Chinese cook, with his regard for propriety, notwithstanding pestilence and the difficulty of provisioning, invariably set before her. And then, sinking into the long rattan upon one, follow it up and absorb herself in its attendant train. She wondered vaguely what there was for her in the various impressions which her conversations with the nuns had left upon her. It was singular that, though their way of life so profoundly moved her, the faith which occasioned it left her untouched. She could not envisage the possibility that she might at any time be captured by the ardour of belief. She gave a little sigh. Perhaps it would make everything easier if that great white light should illuminate her soul. Once or twice she had had the desire to tell the Mother Superior of her unhappiness and its cause, but she dared not. She could not bear that this austere woman should think ill of her. To her, what she had done would naturally seem a grievous sin. The odd thing was that she herself could not regard it as wicked, so much as stupid and ugly. Perhaps it was due to an obtuseness in herself that she looked upon her connection with Townsend as regrettable and shocking even, but to be forgotten rather than to be repented of. It was like making a blunder at a party. There was nothing to do about it. It was dreadfully mortifying, but it showed a lack of sense to ascribe too much importance to it. She shuddered as she thought of Charlie with his large frame too well covered, the vagueness of his jaw, and the way he had of standing with his chest thrown out, so that he might not seem to have a paunch. His sanguine temperament showed itself in the little red veins which soon would form a network on his ruddy cheeks. She had liked his bushy eyebrows. There was to her in them now something animal and repulsive. And the future. It was curious how indifferent it left her. She could not see into it at all. Perhaps she would die when her baby was born. Her sister Doris had always been much stronger than she, and Doris had nearly died. She had done her duty and produced an heir to the new baronetcy. Kitty smiled as she thought of her mother's satisfaction. If the future was so vague, it meant perhaps that she was destined never to see it. Walter would probably ask her mother to take care of the child, if the child survived, and she knew him well enough to be sure that, however uncertain of his paternity, he would treat it with kindness. Walter could be trusted under any circumstances to behave admirably. It was a pity that with his great qualities, his unselfishness and honour, his intelligence and sensibility, he should be so unlovable. She was not in the least frightened of him now, but sorry for him, and at the same time she could not help thinking him slightly absurd. The depth of his emotion made him vulnerable, and she had a feeling that somehow, and at some time, she could so work upon it as to induce him to forgive her. The thought haunted her now, that in thus giving him peace of mind, she would make the only possible amends for the anguish she had caused him. It was a pity he had so little sense of humour. She could see them both some day laughing together at the way they had tormented themselves. She was tired. She took the lamp into her room and undressed. She went to bed and presently fell asleep. Chapter 62. But she was awakened by a loud knocking. At first, since it was interwoven with the dream from which she was aroused, she could not attach the sound to reality. The knocking went on, and she was conscious that it must be at the gateway of the compound. It was quite dark. She had a watch with phosphorized hands and saw that it was 2:30. It must be Walter coming back. How late he was, and he could not awake the boy. The knocking went on, louder and louder, and in the silence of the night it was really not a little alarming. The knocking stopped, and she heard the withdrawing of the heavy bolt. Walter had never come back so late. Poor thing, he must be tired out. She hoped he would have the sense to go straight to bed instead of working as usual in that laboratory of his. There was a sound of voices, and people came into the compound. That was strange, for Walter coming home late, in order not to disturb her, took pains to be quiet. Two or three persons ran swiftly up the wooden steps and came into the room next door. Kitty was a little frightened. At the back of her mind was always the fear of an anti-foreign riot. Had something happened? Her heart began to beat quickly. But before she had time to put her vague apprehension into shape, someone walked across the room and knocked at her door. Mrs. Fane. She recognized Waddington's voice. Yes, what is it?
Will you get up at once? I have something to say to you.
She rose and put on a dressing gown. She unlocked the door and opened it. Her glance took in Waddington in a pair of Chinese trousers and a pongee coat, the houseboy holding a hurricane lamp, and a little further back, three Chinese soldiers in khaki. She started as she saw the consternation on Waddington's face. His head was tousled as though he had just jumped out of bed.
What is the matter? She gasped.
You must keep calm. There's not a moment to lose. Put on your clothes at once and come with me.
But what is it? Has something happened in the city?
The sight of the soldiers suggested to her at once that there had been an outbreak and they were come to protect her. Your husband's been taken ill. We want you to come at once.
Walter,
she cried. You mustn't be upset. I don't exactly know what's the matter. Colonel Yu sent this officer to me and asked me to bring you to the Yamen at once.
Kitty stared at him for a moment. She felt a sudden cold in her heart, and then she turned.
I shall be ready in 2 minutes.
I came just as I was, he answered. I was asleep. I just put on a coat and some shoes.
She did not hear what he said. She dressed by the light of the stars, taking the first things that came to hand. Her fingers, on a sudden, were so clumsy that it seemed to take her an age to find the little clasps that closed her dress. She put round her shoulders the Cantonese shawl she had worn in the evening.
I haven't put a hat on. There's no need, is there?
No.
The boy held the lantern in front of them, and they hurried down the steps and out of the compound gate.
Take care you don't fall, said Waddington. You'd better hang on to my arm.
The soldiers followed immediately behind them. Colonel Yu has sent chairs. They're waiting on the other side of the river. They walked quickly down the hill. Kitty could not bring herself to utter the question that trembled so horribly on her lips. She was mortally afraid of the answer. They came to the bank, and there, with a thread of light at the bow, a sampan was waiting for them.
Is it cholera?
She said then.
I'm afraid so.
She gave a little cry and stopped short.
I think you ought to come as quickly as you can.
He gave her his hand to help her into the boat. The passage was short and the river almost stagnant. They stood in a bunch at the bow, while a woman with a child tied on her hip, with one oar, impelled the sampan across.
He was taken ill this afternoon, the afternoon of yesterday, that is, said Waddington.
Why wasn't I sent for at once? Although there was no reason for it, they spoke in whispers. In the dark at him. Colonel Yu has been with him all the time. He ought to have sent for me all the same. It's heartless.
Your husband knew that you had never seen anyone with cholera. It's a terrible and revolting sight. He didn't want you to see it.
After all, he is my husband.
Colonel Yu has been with him all the time. He ought to have sent for me all the same. It's heartless.
Your husband knew that you had never seen anyone with cholera. It's a terrible and revolting sight. He didn't want you to see it.
After all, he is my husband, she said in a kiss.
Your husband knew that you had never seen anyone with cholera. It's a terrible and revolting sight. He didn't want you to see it.
After all, he is my husband, she said in a choking voice.
Waddington made no reply.
Why am I allowed to come now?
Waddington put his hand on her arm. My dear, you must be very brave. You must be prepared for the worst.
She gave a wail of anguish and turned away a little, for she saw that the three Chinese soldiers were looking at her. She had a sudden strange glimpse of the whites of their eyes. Is he dying?
I only know the message Colonel Yu gave to this officer who came and fetched me. As far as I can judge, collapse has set in.
Is there no hope at all?
I'm dreadfully sorry. I'm afraid that if we don't get there quickly, we shan't find him alive.
She shuddered. The tears began to stream down her cheeks.
You see, he's been overworking. He has no powers of resistance.
She withdrew from the pressure of his arm with a gesture of irritation. It exasperated her that he should talk in that low, anguished voice. They reached the side, and two men, Chinese coolies, standing on the bank, helped her to step on shore. The chairs were waiting. As she got into hers, Waddington said to her,
"Try and keep a tight hold on your nerves. You'll want all your self-control. Tell the bearers to make haste. They have orders to go as fast as they can."
The officer, already in his chair, passed by, and as he passed, called out to Kitty's bearers. They raised the chair smartly, arranged the poles on their shoulders, and at a swift pace set off. Waddington followed close behind. They took the hill at a run, a man with a lantern going before each chair, and at the water gate, the gatekeeper was standing with a torch. The officer shouted to him as they approached, and he flung open one side of the gate to let them through. He uttered some sort of interjection as they passed, and the bearers called back. In the dead of the night, those guttural sounds in a strange language were mysterious and alarming. They slithered up the wet and slippery cobbles of the alley, and one of the officer's bearers stumbled. Kitty heard the officer's voice raised in anger, the shrill retort of the bearer, and then the chair in front hurried on again. The streets were narrow and tortuous. Here in the city was deep night. It was a city of the dead. They hastened along a narrow lane, turned a corner, and then at a run took a flight of steps. The bearers were beginning to blow hard. They walked with long, rapid strides, in silence. One took out a ragged handkerchief, and as he walked, wiped from his forehead the sweat that ran down into his eyes. They wound this way and that, so that it might have been a maze through which they sped. In the shadow of the shuttered shops, sometimes a form seemed to be lying, but you did not know whether it was a man who slept to awake at dawn, or a man who slept to awake never. The narrow streets were ghostly in their silent emptiness, and when, on a sudden, a dog barked loudly, it sent a shock of terror through Kitty's tortured nerves. She did not know where they went. The way seemed endless. Could they not go faster, faster, faster? The time was going, and any moment it might be too late. Chapter 63. Suddenly, walking along a blank long wall, they came to a gateway flanked by sentry boxes, and the bearers set down the chairs. Waddington hurried up to Kitty. She had already jumped out. The officer knocked loudly on the door and shouted. A postern was opened, and they passed into a courtyard. It was large and square. Huddled against the walls, under the eaves of the overhanging roofs, soldiers wrapped in their blankets were lying in huddled groups. They stopped for a moment while the officer spoke to a man who might have been a sergeant, on guard. He turned and said something to Waddington.
"He's still alive," said Waddington in a low voice. "Take care how you walk."
Still preceded by the men with lanterns, they made their way across the yard, up some steps, through a great doorway, and then down into another wide court. On one side of this was a long chamber with lights in it. The lights within, shining through the rice paper, silhouetted the elaborate pattern of the lattice. The lantern bearers led them across the yard towards this room, and at the door the officer knocked. It was opened immediately, and the officer, with a glance at Kitty, stepped back.
"Will you walk in?" said Waddington.
It was a long, low room, and the smoky lamps that lit it made the gloom ominous. Three or four orderlies stood about. On a pallet against the wall opposite the door,
A man was lying huddled under a blanket. An officer was standing motionless at the foot. Kitty hurried up and leaned over the pallet. Walter lay with his eyes closed, and in that somber light, his face had the greyness of death. He was horribly still.
"Walter, Walter," she gasped in a low, terrified tone.
There was a slight movement in the body, or the shadow of a movement. It was so slight, it was like a breath of air which you cannot feel, and yet for an instant ruffles the surface of still water.
"Walter, Walter, speak to me."
The eyes were open slowly, as though it were an infinite effort to raise those heavy lids. But he did not look. He stared at the wall a few inches from his face. He spoke. His voice, low and weak, had the hint of a smile in it.
"This is a pretty kettle of fish," he said.
Kitty dared not breathe. He made no further sound, no beginning of a gesture, but his eyes, those dark, cold eyes of his, seeing now what mysteries, stared at the whitewashed wall. Kitty raised herself to her feet. With haggard gaze, she faced the man who stood there.
"Surely something can be done. You're not going to stand there and do nothing."
She clasped her hands. Waddington spoke to the officer who stood at the end of the bed. "I'm afraid they've done everything that was possible. The regimental surgeon has been treating him. Your husband has trained him, and he's done all that your husband could do himself."
"Is that the surgeon?"
"No, that is Colonel Yu. He's never left your husband's side." Distracted, Kitty gave him a glance. He was a tallish man, but stockily built, and he seemed ill at ease in his khaki uniform. He was looking at Walter, and she saw that his eyes were wet with tears. It gave her a pang. Why should that man, with his yellow, flat face, have tears in his eyes? It exasperated her.
"It's awful to be able to do nothing."
"At least he's not in pain anymore," said Waddington. She leaned once more over her husband. Those ghastly eyes of his still stared vacantly in front of him. She could not tell if he saw with them. She did not know whether he had heard what was said. She put her lips close to his ears.
"Walter, isn't there something we can do?"
She thought that there must be some drug they could give him which would stay the dreadful ebbing of his life. Now that her eyes were more accustomed to the dimness, she saw with horror that his face had fallen. She would hardly have recognized him. It was unthinkable that in a few short hours he should look like another man. He hardly looked like a man at all. He looked like death. She thought that he was making an effort to speak. She put her ear close.
"Don't fuss. I've had a rough passage, but I'm all right now."
Kitty waited for a moment, but he was silent. His immobility rent her heart with anguish. It was terrifying that he should lie so still. He seemed prepared already for the stillness of the grave. Someone, the surgeon or a dresser, came forward and with a gesture motioned her aside. He leaned over the dying man and with a dirty rag wet his lips. Kitty stood up once more and turned to Waddington despairingly.
"Is there no hope at all?" she whispered.
He shook his head.
"How much longer can he live?"
"No one can tell. An hour, perhaps?" Kitty looked round the bare chamber, and her eyes rested for an instant on the substantial form of Colonel Yu.
"Can I be left alone with him for a little while?" she asked. "Only for a minute."
"Certainly, if you wish it." Waddington stepped over to the Colonel and spoke to him. The Colonel gave a little bow, and then, in a low tone, an order. "We shall wait on the steps," said Waddington as they trooped out. "You have only to call." Now that the incredible had overwhelmed her consciousness, like a drug coursing through her veins, and she realized that Walter was going to die, she had but one thought, and that was to make his end easier for him by dragging from his soul the rancor which poisoned it. If he could die at peace with her, it seemed to her that he would die at peace with himself. She thought now not of herself at all, but only of him. "Walter, I beseech you to forgive me," she said, leaning over him. For fear that he could not bear the pressure, she took care not to touch him. "I'm so her to use it, a commonplace of her vocabulary, to dogs and babies and motor cars." Then something horrible occurred. She clenched her hands, trying with all her might to control herself, for she saw two tears run slowly down his wasted cheeks. "Oh, my precious, my dear, if you ever loved me, I know you loved me and I was hateful. I beg you to forgive me. I've no chance now to show my repentance. Have mercy on me. I beseech you to forgive." She stopped. She looked at him all breathless, waiting passionately for a reply. She saw that he tried to speak. Her heart gave a great bound. It seemed to her that it would be in a manner a reparation for the suffering she had caused him, if at this last moment she could effect his deliverance from that load of bitterness. His lips moved. He did not look at her. His eyes stared unseeing at the whitewashed wall. She leaned over him so that she might hear, but he spoke quite clearly. "The dog it was that died." She stayed as still as though she were turned to stone. She could not understand and gazed at him in terrified perplexity. It was meaningless. Delirium. He had not understood a word she said. It was impossible to be so still and yet to live. She stared and stared. His eyes were open. She could not tell if he breathed. She began to grow frightened. "Walter," she whispered. "Walter." At last, suddenly, she raised herself. A sudden fear seized her. She turned and went to the door. "Will you come, please? He doesn't seem to..." They stepped in. The Chinese surgeon went up to the bed. He had an electric torch in his hand, and he lit it and looked at Walter's eyes. Then he closed them. He said something in Chinese. Waddington put his arm round Kitty. "I'm afraid he's dead." Kitty gave a deep sigh. A few tears fell from her eyes. She felt dazed rather than overcome. The Chinese stood about round the bed helplessly, as though they did not quite know what to do next. Waddington was silent. In a minute, the Chinese began to speak in a low tone among themselves. "You'd better let me take you back to the bungalow," said Waddington. "He'll be brought there." Kitty passed her hand wearily across her forehead. She went up to the pallet bed and leaned over it. She kissed Walter gently on the lips. She was not crying now. "I'm sorry to give you so much trouble." The officers saluted as she passed, and she gravely bowed. They walked back across the courtyard and got into their chairs. She saw Waddington light a cigarette. A little smoke lost in the air. That was the life of man. Chapter 64. Dawn was breaking now, and here and there a Chinese was taking down the shutters of his shop. In its dark recesses, by the light of a taper, a woman was washing her hands and face. In a tea house at a corner, a group of men were eating an early meal. The grey cold light of the rising day sidled along the narrow lanes like a thief. There was a pale mist on the river, and the masts of the crowded junks loomed through it like the lances of a phantom army. It was chilly as they crossed, and Kitty huddled herself up in her gay and coloured shawl. They walked up the hill, and they were above the mist. The sun shone from an unclouded sky. It shone as though this were a day like another, and nothing had happened to distinguish it from its fellows. "Wouldn't you like to lie down?" said Waddington when they entered the bungalow. "No, I'll sit at the window." She had sat at the window so often and so long during the weeks that had passed, and her eyes now were so familiar with the fantastic, garish, beautiful and mysterious temple on its great bastion that it rested her spirit. It was so unreal, even in the crude light of midday, that it withdrew her from the reality of life. I'll get the boy to make you some tea. I'm afraid it will be necessary to bury him this morning. I'll make all the arrangements.
Thank you.
Chapter 65. They buried him 3 hours later. It seemed horrible to Kitty that he must be put into a Chinese coffin, as though in so strange a bed he must rest uneasily, but there was no help for it. The nuns, learning of Walter's death as they learned everything that happened in the city, sent by messenger a cross of dahlias, stiff and formal, but made as though by the accustomed hands of a florist, and the cross, alone on the Chinese coffin, looked grotesque and out of place. When all was ready, they sent by messenger a cross of dahlias, stiff and formal, but made as though by the accustomed hands of a florist, and the cross, alone on the Chinese coffin, looked grotesque and out of place. When all was ready, they had to wait for Colonel Yu, who had sent to Waddington to say that he desired to attend the funeral. He came accompanied by an ADC. They walked up the hill, the coffin borne by half a dozen coolies, to a little plot of land where lay buried the missionary whose place Walter had taken. Waddington had found among the missionary's effects an English prayer book, and in a low voice, with an embarrassment that was unusual to him, read the burial service. Perhaps, reciting those solemn but terrible words, the thought hovered in his mind that if he, in his turn, fell a victim to the pestilence, there would be no one now to say them over him. The coffin was lowered into the grave, and the grave diggers began to throw in the earth. Colonel Yu, who had stood with bared head by the graveside, put on his hat, saluted Kitty gravely, said a word or two to Waddington, and followed by his ADC, walked away. The coolies, curious to watch a Christian burial, had lingered, and now, in a straggling group, their yokes trailing in their hands, sauntered off. Kitty and Waddington waited till the grave was filled, and then placed on the mound, smelling of fresh earth, the nun's prim dahlias. She had not wept, but when the first shovelful of earth rattled on the coffin, she felt a dreadful pang at her heart. She saw that Waddington was waiting for her to come away. "Are you in a hurry?" she asked. "I don't want to go back to the bungalow just yet." "I have nothing to do. I'm entirely in your hands." Chapter 66. They sauntered along the causeway till they came to the top of the hill, on which stood that archway, the memorial to a virtuous widow, which had occupied so large a part of Kitty's impression of the place. It was a symbol, but of what she scarcely knew. She could not tell why it bore a note of so sardonic irony. "Shall we sit down a little? We haven't sat here for ages." The plain was spread before her widely. It was tranquil and serene in the morning light. "It's only a few weeks that I've been here, and it seems a lifetime." He did not answer, and for a while she allowed her thoughts to wander. She gave a sigh. "Do you think that the soul is immortal?" she asked. He did not seem surprised at the question.
"How should I know?"
"Just now, when they'd washed Walter, before they put him into the coffin, I looked at him. He looked very young, too young to die. Do you remember that beggar that we saw the first time you took me for a walk? I was frightened, not because he was dead, but because he looked as though he'd never been a human being. He was just a dead animal. And now again, with Walter, it looked so like a machine that has run down. That's what is so frightening. And if it is only a machine, how futile is all this suffering and the heart pains and the misery?" He did not answer, but his eyes travelled over the landscape at their feet. The wide expanse on that gay and sunny morning filled the heart with exultation. The trim little rice fields stretched as far as the eye could see, and in many of them the blue-clad peasants with their buffaloes were working industriously. It was a peaceful and a happy scene. Kitty broke the silence. I can't tell you how deeply moved I've been by all I've seen at the convent. They're wonderful, those nuns. They make me feel utterly worthless. They give up everything, their home, their country, love, children, freedom, and all the little things which I sometimes think must be harder still to give up. Flowers and green fields, going for a walk on an autumn day, books and music, comfort, everything they give up, everything. And they do it so that they may devote themselves to a life of sacrifice and poverty, obedience, killing work, and prayer. To all of them, this world is really and truly a place of exile. Life is a cross which they willingly bear, but in their hearts all the time is the desire. Oh, it's so much stronger than desire. It's a longing, an eager, passionate longing for the death which shall lead them to life everlasting. Kitty clasped her hands and looked at him with anguish.
Well?
Supposing there is no life everlasting, think what it means if death is really the end of all things. They've given up all for nothing. They've been cheated. They're dupes.
Waddington reflected for a little while.
I wonder. I wonder if it matters that what they have aimed at is illusion. Their lives are in themselves beautiful. I have an idea that the only thing which makes it possible to regard this world we live in without disgust is the beauty which now and then men create out of the chaos. The pictures they paint, the music they compose, the books they write, and the lives they lead. Of all these, the richest in beauty is the beautiful life. That is the perfect work of art.
Kitty sighed. What he said seemed hard. She wanted more.
Have you ever been to a symphony concert? He continued.
Yes, she smiled. I know nothing of music, but I'm rather fond of it.
Each member of the orchestra plays his own little instrument. And what do you think he knows of the complicated harmonies which unroll themselves on the indifferent air? He is concerned only with his own small share. But he knows that the symphony is lovely, and though there's none to hear it, it is lovely still, and he is content to play his part.
You spoke of Tao the other day, said Kitty after a pause. Tell me what it is.
Waddington gave her a little look, hesitated an instant, and then with a faint smile on his comic face answered,
It is the way and the way-goer. It is the eternal road along which walk all beings, but no being made it, for itself is being. It is everything and nothing. From it all things spring, all things conform to it, and to it, at last, all things return. It is a square without angles, a sound which ears cannot hear, and an image without form. It is a vast net, and though its meshes are as wide as the sea, it lets nothing through. It is the sanctuary where all things find refuge. It is nowhere, but without looking out of the window, you may see it. Desire not to desire, it teaches, and leave all things to take their course. He that humbles himself shall be preserved entire. He that bends shall be made straight. Failure is the foundation of success, and success is the lurking place of failure. But who can tell when the turning point will come? He who strives after tenderness can become even as a little child. Gentleness brings victory to him who attacks, and safety to him who defends. Mighty is he who conquers himself.
Does it mean anything?
Sometimes, when I've had half a dozen whiskies and look at the stars, I think perhaps it does.
Silence fell upon them, and when it was broken, it was again by Kitty.
Tell me, is The Dog It Was That Died a quotation?
Waddington's lips outlined a smile, and he was ready with his answer. But perhaps at that moment, his sensibilities were abnormally acute. Kitty was not looking at him, but there was something about her expression which made him change his mind.
If it is, I don't know it, he answered warily. Why?
Nothing. It crossed my mind.
It had a familiar ring. There was another silence.
End of side 10.